Military Security Blankets, a program from the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara. In the long history of military science, the importance of strategic positions has always been emphasized. Until recent times, Britain fought to hold Gibraltar, Malta, and the Suez Canal as a lifeline to her empire. In the United States, the Panama Canal, since it was built, has seemed critical to the security of the country. In this program, a distinguished military authority argues not only that the Panama Canal is no longer of major significance, but that the power and influence of the United States is determined by factors having nothing to do with strategic real estate. The speaker, General James M. Gavin, has engaged in some interesting campaigns both during his distinguished military career and afterward. He resigned as chief of planning at the Pentagon in 1958 in disagreement with John Foster Dulles's policy of massive nuclear retaliation. He brought down the wrath of his superiors when he tried to convince President Eisenhower to abolish the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he became one of the best informed and most relentless critics of the pattern of military escalation in Vietnam. After 2 years in Paris as United States Ambassador to France, he came home to advocate a major reduction of American forces in Europe. On the political front, General Gavin resigned his position on the Massachusetts Democratic Party Advisory Council during the latter years of the Johnson administration, warning that the continuation of the Vietnam War and Johnson's economic policies would wreck the country. General Gavin is now chairman of Arthur D. Little Incorporated, a planning firm whose clients include a number of developing countries. He meets regularly with presidents and prime ministers of Latin American and African countries, and has set his planners to work on schemes for a Latin American common market and an ultimate hemispheric union. In this program, General Gavin shares his ideas with Center Fellows in a wide-ranging presentation. He starts with comments on an article by Senator J. William Fulbright on the Cold War.
We seem to be caught up in a whirlwind of change, and we seek cliches and old dogmas for the comfort they may give us as a basis for taking positions. And so often we've been so wrong. I was in the Pentagon and working in the Council on Foreign Relations at the time of the massive retaliation at the time and place of our choosing, and felt with very deep conviction that that policy was absolutely wrong. It was obviously inflexible, obviously unresponsive to national need, and was based on economics, really, in my opinion. And indeed, I left the service on the basis of that, and leaving, felt that we should have a more flexible strategy. Now, our strategy led us down the road, as Fulbright so carefully and eloquently points out, to limited and unlimited war, and now we're involved in apparently counterinsurgency actions in which we provide the money and the weapons and the bombers, and someone else does the dying for the issues that we feel are worth that effort.
General Gavin moves on from this point to explain that the Cold War between capitalism and communism no longer has a place in a world whose security rests with five power centers rather than only with the United States and Russia.
I feel we have now really five power blocks emerging quite clearly. Europe is one, of course the United States, Russia, China, and Japan. I would put Japan very high on the list now. Now, what are the assumptions on which one bases such observations? First of all, what is the basis of power in the kind of world in which we're entering, where we are now? Is it weapons? Is it numbers of divisions? Aircraft carrier task forces? Is it economics, or what is it? Well, I really think a very fundamental change in values has taken place in the society of this earth, and that is that economics is becoming more important to people. That is, an adequate standard of living, food, reasonable shelter, non-exploitation of their natural resources. We've got to get away from this ratio of one-third of the human race uses two-thirds of the Earth's resources, because it cannot go on indefinitely. I have a feeling, therefore, that economics is becoming a very important and overriding important. Next, the domestic condition of a people. Now, take our own country. the problems of housing, transportation, environment, education, health care, all are of critical importance, and they're under searching examination by various groups. We have a marvelously efficient way of extracting money from people, but when it comes to administering, we go back to those cartographic delineations made by our forefathers 200 years ago. In my opinion, we've got to get our own society organized so we have a reasonable organization. We're far from administering ourselves efficiently. And this is what really begins to bother people, because we hear talk about a VAT system, a tax system. Well, now, if we find more ways of getting more money out of the system and out of people, people won't stand for it without finding better ways of administering the system. And this is just as important, getting money out of people. I think the VAT system, you would probably, most of you disagree with this, I think it's a very good idea.
Value-added tax?
Yes, the value-added tax. I guess you all understand what it is. Take, for example, forestry is a big business out in California. If a man cuts down a tree and it costs him $1 to deliver it, let's say arbitrarily, he doesn't get $1. There's 5% tax added to it. So he gets $1.05, but that 5 cents goes to the government. Then when it's processed into finished lumber, it's then worth, say, $2, but there's another 5 cents added to it, so it's $2.10. And then when it's made into a cabinet, there's perhaps another 10% added to it, so there's a 20% tax in it, and it sells to the consumer at around $4.20, but 20 cents goes to the government. What disturbs me about this system is that I think now that the government is going to get itself in a position where we're all going to be working 5 days, but 3 days is going to be for the government to support the hidden taxes. It means that our modern production methods, automation, efficiency in management and control of information and all this, control of inventory, if better marketing and so on, all means that we're all going to be doing a great deal more work for Uncle Sam. Well, if this is the case, we better get him administering the country better than he's now administering it. I'm talking about the importance of domestic affairs in the United States, but it's just as important in other countries. They're all having their problems, including the Soviet Union. Well, now, of overriding importance to me is economics, the domestic condition, and what people are doing about their future. I would base the strength of a nation upon a tripod of these three things to begin with. And indeed, I would call this a strategic measure of a nation's role in global affairs. And indeed, I would say further that the problem in Southeast Asia is not that we couldn't win tactical battles. We can win them all day long. But when we expend $30 billion a year at the expense of a national strategy to win tactical battles that accomplish nothing more than loss of life and destruction of property, we are on a strategically losing course of a very serious sort, and we better realize it and wake up to it and do something about it. In fact, this is why I think we ought to be out of Southeast Asia right now. Well, now, if I were to use these parameters as a rough measure of stature of nations, I would clearly give high marks to the Europe, Japan, China, Russia as power centers comparable to our own. And these are the power centers we've got to begin to think of, and the interplay of these and how they relate in terms of the various problems of nationalization, use of information, management of resources. A corollary to this problem is the runaway growth of the multinational corporation, which is also at play in global affairs. Today, there's much discussion in the press about the multinational corporation, good and bad. How socially responsible is it? What does it do? If you talk to the multinational people, they'll say, we export technology, capital, and management know-how, and thus we help the underdeveloped countries achieve things they never would have dreamt of, but now we're helping them do it. And those who are against this say what they're doing is using cheap foreign labor to develop, make products to sell in the American market at the expense of American labor, and that's currently a very hot issue. But that is a very important thing. The interesting thing to me about that is that while we talk about the political arrangements among nations and organize such things as NATO, United Nations, ComCon, the multinational corporation goes on willy-nilly becoming not only multinational but trans-ideological as well, going behind the Iron Curtain, growing with not many inhibitions and constraints, but also without getting together with other multinational corporations to relate common goals and aspirations in a way through discussion and making some sense out of what they're doing. This is a very important phenomenon of our times. Well, I guess what I'm saying then is that in my personal conviction, not only has the Cold War come to a crashing end a long time ago, really, I think that if my assumptions have any validity at all, the parameters of stature and achievement now are such that the growth of the undeveloped nation, the role that Europe will play, the role that Japan will play, are all of very great and overriding importance to the future of the United States, and we must find our way to live in this kind of a world. This is a different world entirely than the Cold War world. It's entirely a different world.
Harry S. Ashmore, president of the Center, begins the discussion with a question.
How does the present and prospective status of arms control and disarmament look to you?
Yeah. First of all, we've made far more progress than I thought we would. Both sides continue to arm, presumably. MIRV has been deployed now by the Soviets, according to the press. And we, I guess, have deployed a multi-warhead missile as well. When I talked to Mr. Kosygin, I guess the most eloquent plea he made was, for goodness sakes, why can't we stop racing each other in arms and armament and get on with doing things about our society that needs such doing? The environment particularly. We simply got to take care of our own environment and not race endlessly on a course of killing. Personally, I think that our problems stem from this. The military establishment of this country was taught to believe that they should exploit technology to the utmost to provide the most modern and sophisticated weapon. They're all taught that the Germans won the Franco-Prussian War because of the needle gun. I remember a general saying, just remember one thing, dollars don't count. If it's technically possible, let's get it. They had a feeling that their duty compelled them to exploit new technology to the point that they were building things that were nonsense and worthless. They didn't want to be caught being responsible for not having used the latest technology. I know that it's very necessary that we bring our race to a stop. I know why it started. I know why we're where we are. But someone's got to make decisions to change this and put our national resources onto the proper priorities. And I think we can do this without very grave risk. Indeed, I would suspect that the budget could be brought from around $76 billion to around $60 anyway. Now, in the meantime, I take it from talking to the Soviets that their intentions are good. They want to find a way to stop it. And I take it that our own negotiators want to also. The really evil characters in this situation are frequently the generals and admirals who are motivated to do what they do because they've really been brought up to believe that this is what they're supposed to do. And someone like the president must talk to them and get the thing straightened out.
General, something that's been bothering me when we're talking about a new foreign policy.
John Cogley, editor of the Center magazine.
I'd be interested in your notions of what you think the presiding idea of that policy would be, in the sense that, let's say that no entangling alliances was once a presiding idea.
Yes.
Or collective security was an idea, or containment of communism was an idea, or even make the world safer democracy was an idea. I don't know if you thought about it. Can you think of a presiding idea under which you might put all the other things?
The way our policy has been formulated up to now was to decide what the vital issues were, what was vital to the security of the United States. One was not to allow foreign troops to land in the United States, you know, for example, is a thing. Or we might decide the retention of the Hawaiian Islands under United States control was vital. And having arrived at such judgments, we then entered into treaty arrangements to protect our vital interests, such as CENFO, CETO, and so on. I'm inclined to go the same way. What should the nation's objectives be by the year 2000? And what should the intermediate objectives be by the year 1980, say? I think then we should begin to give some description to how we would get there. The rate of shrinkage of the earth in terms of instant communications is such that what were vital, I don't think, are really so vital now. I would suppose 25 years ago, the retention of Cuba under our own control or not in the hands of a foreign power would have been cause for war, and yet we seem to live with it now. I would base my judgment on what is vital to the future of the United States in terms of the three things I've talked about before, that is the use of the nation's resources. And I think that our economic relationships with people is perhaps now one of the very vital ingredients to a prospering and happy country in the next 20, 25 years. I don't think things such as the Panama Canal, and now we're talking about Mahan's influence of sea power, you know, nor the Dardanelles, nor the Suez. I don't think the loss of those are vital anymore. And yet a generation ago, we would consider these things as being vital to our national security. I don't think so. I think what is vital in the future is different than what was vital a generation ago. This is part of the change world in which we're living.
Part of the change has to do with the obsolescence of old political units.
Robert Rosen, visiting center fellow.
For example, what you were talking about in the United States, the states as such don't play the dominant functional roles anymore. Same is true on the international level. Do you see any kind of political instrumentalities which can transfer political autonomy to the new regions?
You know, this in itself is a very important subject. We got to get the administration of our social problems out of the hands of the politician. I thought possibly the president might take an ex-governor and their number of good administrative ability and ask one of them to take a four-year appointment to head a particular region of the country as a substitute for an elected vice president. We have very good governors from time to time going out of office who could do this very well. It's terribly important that we not separate people from the management of these resources and dealing with these problems, to take it out of context of our society and dream of it as an IBM system is absolute disaster. You've got to get people and into it and give them a sense of participation. And I would think that in each region you'd have a committee of people from that region representing blacks, women, minorities, and there would be political representation too. What we've got to do is organize in regions and put politically competent as well as good administrators in charge of each region. And then finally within those areas we've got to do a lot better job of administering than we're now doing. Right now we're on the threshold of very serious discontent and distrust and lack of credibility in the government.
Early in your remarks, General, you pointed out that a small minority of the population of the world are using a great majority of the resources.
Sidney Holt, now speaking, is a visiting center fellow.
Yeah. And you said that will have to change, that must change,
yeah.
I think there was. I wonder why it must change. It seems to me very likely that the great powers and military strategy will be more and more directed to retaining their proportion of the consumption of the resources.
Yeah.
This may be a very pessimistic view, but I don't see exactly what forces are acting, say, on this continent that will change. In fact, I think the political forces are set as to intensify the desire to retain what has been secured for this minority of the world's population.
Yeah. I don't, think that's necessarily pessimistic. I think mine is optimistic. Mine is rather streaked with an ideology, with idealism that probably is not very practical. I'm troubled at times as I seek to find answers to some of these problems. I'm troubled by what I see in prospect. For example, the United Nations did a study about a year ago in which they predicted in 25 years we would be out without silver in the natural state and mercury would disappear and a lot of other materials would be in very short supply, and we would have by then a complete recycling process for many, many things because of the severe shortages. On the other hand, through South America and Africa, you'll ask yourself, how long will these people continue with a lack of material things when they watch television and see the good life that all the others are living? I don't think we can go on indefinitely assuming that people will be happy with a less material society. Now, I don't quite see us giving up what we have either. I don't know how this is all going to work out. But I don't think we can go on assuming that the people in the have-not nations are going to be content.
I had a couple of questions.
Donald McDonald, executive editor of the Center magazine.
One was, how much freedom and how much flexibility do you think a president would have, any president, Mr. Nixon or his successor, if he really wanted to turn the arms race around and do something, say, for peace and work on the domestic issues. How much flexibility does he have vis-a-vis the military?
I must say that I was terribly disappointed in my personal experience with how little power the president has. Mr. Kennedy, whom I just admired tremendously, was in a state of frustrations a great deal of the time, because you got the people on the Hill and they've got the money, and you got the people over in state who've got to do a week study of a paper before it comes out, and he's got to make a decision. And it was very difficult. Now, I think a strong enough president can get the Pentagon under control without any doubt, and President Kennedy tried to by bringing McNamara in, and McNamara tried very, very hard to. And the problem of the Pentagon is a very, very real one. And I've written about this, and the problem still exists, and it is this. You have three principal services. The Marine Corps may sit in the Joint Chiefs and vote when a matter of concern to the Marines comes up. But normally they'll vote with the Chief of Naval Operations. And you have three services really voting. Now, if $1 billion become available, here we are, the three of us. Chief of Naval Operations, Chief of Staff of the Army, Chief of Staff of the Air Force. $1 billion come up. Chief of Naval Operations says, well, I want a new aircraft carrier. And Air Force says, I want a new bomber. And the Army sits in between, can't think of quite what it wants because it doesn't have anything exotic like that to put in inventory. So they say, all right, we'll ask for the carrier this fiscal year, and you'll support me, and next fiscal year I'll support you for the B-1. And so this is the way the programs are formulated. Believe me, this is absolute gospel truth. This is how it works out. And then you see, unfortunately, the poor Secretary of Defense is on top of this pile, and the only pressure or power play he can bring on the chiefs is to threaten to take over some of the decision-making if they don't behave and be more reasonable in what they do. And the Joint Chiefs are very worried about this, and they're constantly saying, well, we got to decide now. We don't want the Secretary of Defense having to decide for us. Now, McNamara did decide for them on a number of situations. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. What we've needed, and I've said so, and I got in hot water for doing it, indeed part of my leaving the service was over this issue, the Secretary of Defense, whoever he is, needs the best advice he can get. And he needs a staff of his own to give him that advice. And we do not need a Joint Chiefs of Staff, because the Joint Chiefs of Staff's log roll to the disadvantage of the country. Now, I recommended that we do away with the Joint Chiefs because they wear two hats. That's the problem. This gentleman on my left is not only Chief of Staff of the Air Force, but he's a member of the Joint Chiefs. Now, he's got to lead the Air Force, and he's got to tell those people in the Air Force they have the best service, the best force in the world, the best equipment, the best weapons, and they want something, he's got to fight for it. So he can't represent the national interest at the same time. So I recommend that we do away with the Joint Chiefs, and when they leave their service, have them as an elder body of advisors to the Secretary of Defense with no service responsibilities. In the meantime, there be no such thing as the Joint Chiefs, but a staff reporting right to the Secretary of Defense. And that staff, in turn, would look at all propositions and all recommendations and all proposals and the budget, and it would be a true DOD budget, not a Joint Chiefs budget. I think the Secretary of Defense needs a good staff. He should make his own decisions, and the services should do what he says. And the Joint Chiefs should be done away with, and when they retire from being chief, be an advisor to the Secretary of Defense as an elder statesman.
Should Congress have a staff also so that it can make intelligent and informed decisions on budget, military appropriations? Should they have a research staff?
Well, they've got a bit of a staff. The Armed Forces Committee of the House and of the Senate both have staffs of their own. And then they have investigatory bodies that they send out into the field to find out what's going on, and they uncover the post-exchange scandals and all this and that. But I was very much interested this year for the first time that Mr. Stennis is very troubled about defense spending. It shakes you when you see how that money is spent over there, and when I say that we could go from $76 billion down to $60 with no trouble at all, I mean this. And I've said this publicly, I've said it in national television, I've said it in the Pentagon, and they know what the problems are, but we're far from solving them. Maybe the president we elect in 72 could pick a very strong Secretary of Defense and could do away with the Joint Chiefs. I remember sitting in the Pentagon after the satellite went up, when our Sputnik 1 went up. We knew Sputnik 1 was going to go up within a week. We predicted it that accurately. But the Joint Chiefs kept checkmating each other and wouldn't put any money in satellites. To me, it was a profoundly disturbing thing, because we shouldn't have gotten ourselves into a difficulty like that, and the Joint Chiefs were responsible for it. I went over to the
Hill the next day and recommend we do away with the Joint Chiefs. And President Eisenhower sent a word right back to the Pentagon, nobody over there will talk about doing away with the Joint Chiefs anymore. So that was the parting of the ways. But anyway, this is a very serious problem, and substantive and real changes have got to be made in the organization of the Pentagon and in the National Defense Act. When we're going to be ready for that, I don't know. Maybe a President 72 could propose it. And it's very, very necessary.
General Governor, I was wondering how you would interpret the Peking visit.
The speaker is George McTee Cahen, director of the Southeast Asia Program at Cornell University and now a visiting center fellow.
Whether you wouldn't see that as an anti-Russian move on the part of the administration, or at least see it within the context of the Soviet-American relationship.
I was very uncomfortable about the Peking visit before it took place. I had lived in the Philippine Islands for a couple of years, and I've been all over Asia, except on the mainland. And there's a great deal involved in face. They see us in a certain way. And certainly they saw the president coming as a supplicant from the barbarian nation. As supplicants have been coming for many years, many generations, and he exposed himself to some extent. And yet I thought it came off very, very well. And I would attribute the fact that it did to their preoccupation with the Soviet confrontation. Now, I've talked to the Russians about the China problem, and it's a very troublesome one. But from the Russians' point of view, Peking is right there. Just through Mongolia, and you got it, and then you got Manchuria, and her war-making capacity is gone. And the Chinese know this. They feel they're very, very vulnerable. And they know the Soviets are building up even now airfields, depots, warehouses, highways, and so on in preparation for what they consider to be an inevitable conflict. This is why the Chinese are building air raid shelters now. It may seem unreal to us, but it isn't to the Russians, nor is it to the Chinese. The one thing that troubled the Russians about the visit was we might play games. And this is what they said, now don't play games with us over this. But yet we're playing games, all right, and they're playing games too. I think that the Chinese were very kind to Mr. Nixon and very reasonable and behaved well because they do want our friendship. They want our friendship in the event of a conflict with the Soviet Union particularly. This is very important to them. The problems they have, in the internal problems in their society, are so enormous, so massive. They've got all they can do to take care of themselves for the next few decades anyway. And the Russians caused them trouble. They want us to be at least friendly to them, and I think this is why they treated Mr. Nixon as they did. I think it came off very, very well.
You have been listening to a discussion of factors that bear on national and international strength and security. The speaker was General James Gavin. Participating in the discussion were Center staff members Harry S. Ashmore, John Cogley, Robert Rosen, Sidney Holt, Donald McDonald, and George McTee Cahen. This program originated at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara.